This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A split decision on two major efforts between Hamilton County and the city of Cincinnati. There's an agreement now on the future of a music venue proposed for the banks, but Mayor John Cranley is opposed to the county's proposal to change the operations of the Metropolitan Sewer District. Governor Matt Bevin in Kentucky is feuding with everyone, Democrats, Republicans, and the head coach of the Louisville Cardinals women's basketball team. He's threatening to call a special session after vetoing the latest pension bill adopted by the General Assembly. We'll have a discussion on those stories coming up. But first, the so-called heartbeat bill is now law in Ohio, but opponents plan to fight it in court.
And the purpose of this bill is really to have a vehicle for the United States Supreme Court so that should it be ready to do so, it could revisit some of its prior rulings.
Let's talk about it now with Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Baumert. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
It's great to be here.
Those of you listening who have questions or comments about this topic, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Joe, this was a bill that was similar to one passed by the legislature before but vetoed by Governor John Kasich. Is the only difference with its adoption this time that Mike DeWine is the governor now?
Well, that's the big difference. Yes, indeed. It was vetoed twice, actually, by Governor Kasich. And the legislature has been trying to pass this for about 8 years. They've been trying to get it through, get it into law. And basically, every time it's kind of been the same. There's been some changes to it, you know, little changes. But the thrust is that the law prohibits an abortion at the point a fetal heartbeat can be detected. And experts say that can be about 6 weeks of pregnancy. And oftentimes that's before women even know they're pregnant. So this effectively could wipe out a lot of abortions in Ohio if it's put on the books. But that's a big if, because we know that this is going to be challenged in court.
Yeah. Is that something that doesn't concern Governor DeWine, that seemed to concern Governor Kasich?
Yeah. Governor Kasich, you know, had said, you know, it was just too far for him. He thought it was unconstitutional and he wouldn't sign it. Governor DeWine is looking at it like, hey, you know, there might be constitutional questions and we know that it will be taken to court, but we have a new court, a new U.S. Supreme Court. We have a more conservative leaning U.S. Supreme Court now. And he feels like, you know, Ohio having a law that gets taken up to that level that overturns Roe versus Wade would be a good thing. So he's, you know, pushing forward with it, went ahead and signed it. And the ACLU's legal director, Freda Levinson, she tells me that they are ready to sue, and they will be filing a suit in federal court soon.
Jesse, we know that this requires detection of a fetal heartbeat at 6 weeks. So what else exactly does this bill, now law, do?
Yeah, so essentially it would penalize doctors or physicians who perform abortions, and they could face a fifth degree felony, which could lead to up to 1 year in prison and a $2,500 fee. Also, they could go before the state medical board and they would potentially face a fine of up to $20,000. That money would go towards foster care and adoption services, any money collected from that. So no women would actually be prosecuted who have an abortion, but it would be the physicians that they would be going after. Also, a point of contention that came up quite a bit is there's no exception for rape or incest. There is an exception for life of the mother. So that was problematic, obviously, for those opponents of the bill, but even some Republicans who chose to vote against it.
In a lot of the press coverage that this bill has gotten in Ohio and similar bills elsewhere, it's commonly referred to as the heartbeat bill. But supporters are calling it a human rights bill now. What do they mean by that?
Well, they're calling it the Human Rights Protection Act, and that came through in the very last stages of consideration of this bill. And I think, you know, honestly, they had used heartbeat bill maybe so long that they thought, oh, we need another name that doesn't immediately conjure up something in your mind. So, the thing, though, about Human Rights Protection Act, those terms could actually sound like something that a Democrat proposes sometimes, because, you know, we hear all about, you know, human rights when Democrats are out, you know, talking about things like immigration and things like that. So, it's an image that draws, or it's a word that, or a meaning, a title, that's what it is, that draws a different image in your mind. So they put that in at the last possible moment.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you have questions or comments about this topic. So this passed the House 56-40, and then the Ohio Senate followed that with an 18-12 approval. We know that some activist groups plan to file lawsuits, but what is the reaction of political opponents been, like Democrats, or I guess if there are any Republicans who oppose this?
Well, the Democrats are actually they've actually taken the steps to form the Ohio Black Maternal Health Caucus. And some of the Black Democratic lawmakers are saying that this law disproportionately affects minorities and low-income Ohioans. And the reason, they say, is that those groups sometimes don't have the money to go elsewhere. And if this law goes into effect, there's nothing really that prevents a pregnant woman who wants an abortion and is at the point where a fetal heartbeat can be detected. That woman could take off and go to, say, like New York or some other state where abortion is legal, and have the procedure done there. So, women who don't have means, who are low income, the lawmakers are saying those are the ones who are disproportionately affected by this. So they've come up with this new caucus, and it's supposed to address the needs of low income and specifically minorities. We also know that there's a problem in minority populations with the mortality rate being higher from maternal mortality. And we also have, a lot more problems with, babies not being being born prematurely or something like that. And so this group is set up to advocate for that population and also help that population in other ways. And they've just come out with this in the past few days. So going forward, it could be really interesting to watch to see what is championed by these lawmakers.
So ACLU of Ohio legal director Frieda Levinson released a statement, quote, "This legislation is blatantly unconstitutional, and we will fight to the bitter end to ensure that this bill is permanently blocked." So the ACLU is planning to sue on behalf of Preterm Cleveland, Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio, Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio, and the Women's Med Center of Dayton. This is legislation that has been struck down by federal judges in Kentucky and Iowa. It looks like there's a similar piece of legislation in Georgia that is yet to be signed. Will this piece of legislation find success in the courts?
So what has happened so far? There have been five other governors who have signed this into law. Like you said, Georgia is still pending. And in North Dakota and Arkansas, it went all the way up to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which essentially said, this isn't in line with the current U.S. Supreme Court. So they found it to be unconstitutional. They said, hey, U.S. Supreme Court, do you want to take a look at it? They declined at the time. And Iowa is an interesting case because it actually went through their state court system. So what's happening right now is, opponents of Roe v. Wade are looking for a different court, maybe the Sixth Circuit, which is over Ohio and Kentucky, or the 11th, which is further south, to say this is a fine law, that it is constitutional, and that would create just some disagreement between the two circuit courts so that the U.S. Supreme Court would have to weigh in. But it's worth noting, so far, no court has found this to be constitutional.
So I want to read a quote from the Washington Post, who talked to Lori Viers. She's described as an anti-abortion activist in Ohio, where she spent years promoting this six-week ban. Quote, "We know that the pro-abortion forces are going to sue, and that's part of the process. We want this bill to go to the Supreme Court. It was written for this purpose." So as you just said, it's something that some people want to see go to the Supreme Court as a challenge to the federal law that was determined by Roe versus Wade allowing abortion. But are Ohio lawmakers expressing that same sentiment? Do they want to see this go to the high court?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Most of them are saying that they are looking forward to seeing this go to the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, Governor DeWine has said that that was his, you know, he knows that that's happening. That's his intent. He wants it to go there. So
we got a call from Nick, who left a message saying that the reason John Kasich vetoed it was due to the cost of taking it to court. And he says DeWine isn't worried about that. Do they anticipate that this will be a costly legal battle?
Oh, of course it will. But here's the hard part. As a reporter, I know we all want to find out what that cost truly is. And a lot of the cost will fall to the state to defend it. We already have attorneys on staff that work for the state. And, you know, it will be very, very hard to know exactly what that cost is.
We got an email from Patricia. She says she's totally outraged by the bill. It basically outlaws all abortions. I'm wondering what the general public thinks about the bill. Has there been any polling data on how rank and file Ohioans feel about this piece of legislation?
So I would say a few weeks ago, Baldwin-Wallace University did a poll on a number of issues facing Ohio, from the gas tax to the heartbeat bill, and it was largely split. So there were some people who really were supportive of this piece of legislation, some people who are very anti this legislation. And just from being in the House on Wednesday, you could really feel that. You could hear the protesters outside, like your recording had, saying, "My body, my choice." There were other protesters out there saying Jesus or praying. So it is a very heightened emotional topic that people feel very personally. And so I think you saw a level of activism at the Ohio State House on Wednesday that you really don't see on too many other topics.
When the next election rolls around for those state lawmakers, how does this shape up as a campaign issue for either side?
Well, if you're Republican, I think it generally, if you voted in favor of this and you're a Republican, you are probably playing to your base. And if you're a Democrat, I think that this is going to be something that you can use in your campaign as a way to say, hey, vote for me. It pretty much went down along party lines. There were, I think, four Republicans, Jesse, in the House that did not vote for this, but they also are not speaking out on it. They're not saying much about it. They just quietly didn't vote for it. And they tend to be, if you look at their district, they tend to be in those districts where this could work against them or it could work for them. So the less they say, the better. But it's a very political issue because the Republicans are very supportive of it. We have a Republican legislature, and the Democrats are very much against it. So if we see a flip in the makeup of the legislature, you're going to see, you know, differences in these kind of policies and the shift in the way of thinking about this issue.
The Senate also passed a bill requiring the cremation or burial of fetal remains. What's the status of that now?
So that's over in the House. It's being considered right now. This is a bill that really came from, if you remember, a few years ago, there was a video that was kind of doctored that purported to say that Planned Parenthood officials were selling fetal body parts. The attorney general did an investigation and found that that was not true. But there was some allegations that after like an autoclave process, the fetal remains were going to landfills in Kentucky. And that sparked, you know, some concern and outrage, which led to these types of bills that would require fetal remains be either cremated or buried. And that's something that Senator Joe Eaker from our area has really championed.
Do we expect the House to take this up?
Yes, they will take it up. They were getting this other abortion bill out, but that's probably going to be the next one on the agenda for them to take up, actually. The people who oppose this bill point out that it will drive up the cost of an abortion. They point out that the woman who is going through an abortion, that all of the things that are required in this bill, you know, having that woman have to sign as far as the disposition of the fetus and that sort of thing, that would be a hardship on the woman's emotional, mental state. And they don't like it. But, you know, it like the heartbeat bill, it seems like there is support for it. The one thing that has kind of kept this bill, it's been around for, you know, as Jesse said, a few years now. The one thing that has been difficult for lawmakers is hospitals. Hospitals often have fetal remains. You know, you think about miscarriages and that, you know, happen in a hospital setting. So, you know, how do they make this apply? And they've really had to work through that legally to try to get the language set so that it didn't affect hospitals in a negative way.
I mean, and really, there have been a couple dozen bills that have passed in the last decade, all of which have made abortion access more restricted. We're not really going the opposite direction. And that's really the goal of the GOP legislature. And there are not enough Democrats to really put up much opposition on these proposals.
Our thanks to Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Baumert and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles for joining us today. Thanks to you both.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Up next, an investor is now interested in the Millennium Hotel downtown that Mayor John Cranley has called a public nuisance. The city and county agree on a plan for a proposed music venue at the Banks, but are still at odds over the operations of the Metropolitan Sewer District. And later, Governor Matt Bevin is not only fighting with the Democrats and Republicans, but also the Louisville women's basketball coach. This is the Friday News Review on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Lots of news this week from the city of Cincinnati and Hamilton County. So joining us now to discuss our Cincinnati Business Courier columnist and reporter, Chris Wetterick. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
And WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Welcome back, Jay.
Hello. I'll fill in the blanks that Chris...
That's very kind of you. I'm glad that you're here to do that.
Oh, really?
We'll see how this goes. We're already off to a terrible start. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you've got questions or comments on the topics we go through. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. So let's start with this music venue at the Banks. This has been discussed for a while, so there appears to be some kind of agreement between the city and the county on how to move forward. What is it?
I thought Bill Reinhart placed this well. He said they have one piece of the puzzle fell into place this week, and another piece came loose.
A little bit loose, yeah.
What did he mean by that?
I don't sense the panic button being pushed, but yeah, it's a little loose, I would say. What happened was the city and the county agreed on a way to pay for the garages that they need to put the music venue on top of. Of course, the music venue's at the Banks. The Banks is in the floodplain, and this is kind of how they built the whole project. They build a layer of garages, and then the buildings go on top of them. So they figured out a way for basically the county to basically pay for the whole garage thing when before the city and the county had split it. And then the city will gradually pay the county back for its share of that. So that was an important step forward. It allows the garages to kind of go where the county wants them to go, which is adjacent to the Bengals Stadium. And so everybody's pretty happy about that at this point. The piece that's loose is they need to move the Hilltop basically, it's a cement plant, right? Mm-hmm. They need to move that away from Paul Brown Stadium, and they want to put a parking lot there so that the Bengals can have tailgating when this music venue is built. When the music venue is built, part of their tailgating land will go away. So the Hilltop companies have some purchase agreements or some initial contracts. I'm not quite sure on the detail on that.
It was letter of intent.
Letter of intent. That's the word I'm looking for. Over in Lower Price Hill, west of the Mill Creek, where the Mill Creek enters the Ohio River, that's a concern for Lower Price Hill. They have designs for a park and some nice community space there. They're a little worried about the barges that would be coming in. Of course, Hilltop's not building a cement plant in Lower Price Hill. It wants to build that in Queensgate, but it needs the barges to move the stuff around, basically. So the solution potentially to that is to put it on some city-owned land west of the Mill Creek.
East of the Mill Creek.
East of the Mill Creek, right.
And, see, he's filling in the blanks, yeah, just like you promised.
I need his help, man. I really do. It's Friday. And so, you know, that's something that needs to be worked out. And the county commissioners were before the city council this week urging that that be worked out, but no solution as of yet.
And the funding was a big piece that kind of came out of nowhere. I was just going through the online council system, and without much fanfare, here's this ordinance that, you know, to fund the music venue. I thought, where'd this come from?
Right.
And sure enough, I mean, the big deal was Mayor Cranley said that since the county gets all of the parking revenue, they didn't think that they should pay for all of the parking garages. And so the county is going to basically, like Chris said, upfront the money and then eventually be paid back with the other money that is spun off by the Banks project.
And that kind of money is, you know, a TIF district money, and, you know, the city gets income taxes theoretically, although it's abated most of the income taxes at General Electric. So it does get some revenue from the banks apart from the parking garage.
Okay, so a couple of quick follow-ups to that then. The Bengals were originally concerned about this project. Are they calmed down now?
Right. They had kind of agreed with the county in principle. They had a kind of whole set of things that they settled with the county, including some game day payments the county was going to owe that it's not really going to owe now. There's a lot of detail related to that. But yeah, the Bengals are okay with this thing going adjacent to the stadium at this point, as long as they get their tailgating space where the concrete plant is.
And help us understand exactly why the county and the city, just from a government perspective, are both involved in this.
It's been that way since the Banks was developed. When the original plan came together for there to be a stadium on the east and a stadium on the west, I guess a ballpark on the east, and the land in between, it was a 50-50 city-county project, and it's had lots of stops and starts, but it is a joint effort and has been since it was first proposed in 1996.
So we're talking about a music venue.
Right.
What does that mean? What do we end up with now?
So there's going to be a building. There'll be an inside. Apparently, it's very nice looking, allegedly. And it's going to be controlled by MEMI, which is a Music and Event Management Inc., which is controlled by the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. It will be an indoor-outdoor venue, meaning that during the winter, you can have the concerts indoors. During the summer and the nice weather, you can have the concerts outdoors on a park area that will be adjacent to it. So the idea, of course, is to bring more people to the banks, to help the retailers and the restaurant people that are there now who kind of are feast and famine based on the events there, whether there's a Bengals or a Reds game. And so the music venue is viewed as a way to bring people to the banks from outside of that, you know, area of the city year round.
And that's something that Mayor Cranley mentioned in an interview with Bill Reinhart, that, you know, the one thing the city gave up, he had been pushing for, I believe it was lot 24.
They already have a garage there, and that's where
right,
he wanted it
to go on the podium that was already there. So this is, and I think that will open up, is that 400,000 square feet of mixed-use development that could go in on top of that podium.
And there is a proposal to do that, mixed-use development. It has not been approved yet, but it's kind of floating out there.
$22 million project, 4,500-seat concert venue. And then is that the seats that would be available inside, and then there would be more
right.
seats outside?
Right.
Lawn capacity for more than 8,000 people?
Right, right. If you remember the Nationals concert last year at about this time, you know, that's kind of what we're talking about. Although that was in Smale Riverfront Park as it exists now, this would be an extension of Smale towards this spot next to Paul Brown Stadium.
City Council will take up the financing plan next week. How does that vote go down?
I've not heard any opposition. The thing will be to see how long it takes to get this little dust up with the Hilltop site. It sounds that the council put a 90-day delay on any development on this Lower Price Hill site, but it looks like that you know, Council Member Amy Murray and Commission President Denise Treehouse don't want it to last that long. And it looks like they could try to pull something together with all the parties in a couple of weeks and see if they can get that worked out.
They want to get it done because they want that music venue open by August of 2020 in time for the Bengals stadium.
I was going to say, that seems a little optimistic, but
yep,
that's a lot of construction that has to happen in less than 18 months.
Yeah, it's a really aggressive timetable.
Because they have to build the parking deck first. They can't even start on the music venue until the parking deck's done.
So how far out do we think this is, this project?
I mean, they say August 2020. I mean, I'm no construction expert, but I think it'll be longer than
that. That's for a garage
and the music venue.
Right.
And I think they probably can do a little work on the venue while the garage is being built, but it almost has to be pretty much done because it sits on top of that garage.
It's a podium.
Yeah.
So this was not a unanimous vote at the Hamilton County Commission, though, right?
It was not. Yeah. Commissioner Stephanie Sumrow-Dumas voted no. She didn't say much about why, so I can't really...
Yeah, so we don't know why she's opposed.
She asked some questions that were kind of to the point of, is the city, you know, are the city and MEMI, are they, you know, how solid is the deal to build the park that's needed? And, you know, I don't know if that's the root of her no vote, but that was a question she asked.
Well, we'll look forward to partying there in about 15 months or so. Let's talk about sewers now. WVXU.
That was a nice transition.
You're welcome. WVXU reported this week, Hamilton County commissioners say they have a plan to end the dysfunction at the Metropolitan Sewer District, the MSD. Dysfunction. Jay, what does that mean?
Well, since 1968, as much as the city and county can work together on the Banks Project and the music venue, they don't really work that well together on the Metropolitan Sewer District.
It's like a mirror. It's like exact opposite universe.
But if their plan that was to announced, I think it was on Monday, was to end the dysfunction at MSD, that's not going to happen because the plan was dead just the second that it came out of the laser printer, because there is no way that the city is going to go along with the plan. And the plan is the county wants to take the 20 executive leadership positions within MSD and make them county employees, thereby giving the county control of the Metropolitan Sewer District, and the city's not going to play ball with that one. There's going to have to be a solution where the city does maintain some operational control of the sewer district. And that's what the plan was, where they came up with this settlement agreement where there would be an independent board with five members, three of them appointed by the county, I think, and two by the city, where the city would still have some control over the sewer district. But the county, the city is not going to turn over 20 executive positions to the county to let them run the sewer system.
What is the governmental makeup of the sewer district?
It gets complicated. The actual
everything with this.
The actual sewer district is owned by
the county.
By the county, and they set the operating budget. So they're the ones that approve the MSD budget. It is managed and operated on a day-to-day basis by the city. And the city will make the argument that part of the reason they're interested in this is that they still own their assets that they brought to the table in 1968 when the sewer district was formed.
Which are some of the most important assets, meaning the sewer plants themselves, right? The sewer, the clean... the gook that comes through the system. So,
so what?
Without those plants, you don't have a sewer system.
What kind of counter proposal do we expect from the mayor or the city council?
I don't know that there's going to be a counter proposal. Basically, this is a court filing that goes back into a case from 2002 when the Sierra Club and others had sued under the Clean Water Act. US EPA was involved with that led to the consent decree to stop the untreated sewage from flowing into local streams and rivers. This is a court filing as a part of that. It's in front of Judge Michael Barrett, who's inherited the case when the previous judge passed away. He'll have to make a decision. He was pretty active in negotiating the agreement that was announced about a year ago, but that ran into a problem because in order for this to work, The employees
had to stay
in the city retirement system. The rule is that if you're a county employee, you have to be in the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System. The city cannot afford to let the MSD employees out of the city system, and that's been the hang-up. They were hoping to get a state law change to allow that to happen, and so far that hasn't happened, and I'd say the longer it goes on, the less likely it's going to happen.
And that deal is really basically dead, I think. And so you're kind of back to square one.
This strikes me as similar to the conversations from about 5 years ago where the Kenton County Airport Board, which runs CBG, needed to be remade in the image of I don't know, modern governance, I suppose, where Kenton County previously had...
Not good old boys, you mean?
Well, I can't say that, but you can.
just did, sorry. Right,
so Kenton County had all the appointments on that board, and now that's not the case. You know, Kenton County has a few, Boone County, Campbell County, Grant County, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, the governor's office, all appoint. So now there's more diversity among the representation there. What happens next for the makeup of this? Does it go to some sort of mediation, or is there some way to mediate these issues that both parties have?
I mean, it's in... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, the only thing that I think is interesting that Judge Michael Barrett, who's overseeing this, is now on senior status. So that means that he's semi-retired. So maybe he has a little bit more time to focus on this. The other thing that's interesting, too, the part of the reason that this is a big deal was there was a settlement with the retirees in the Cincinnati retirement system. Well, guess who oversaw that settlement agreement?
Who?
Judge Michael Barrett.
Oh.
And so basically he has to thread the needle here very carefully, because he can't make too many changes to MSD without severely undoing the settlement that was worked up with the city and the retirees concerning the retirement system. So I assume that, you know, they took one bite at the apple and came up with this agreement. It's for all practical purposes dead unless the state legislature approves the retirement issue. Back to the drawing board and try again.
At the same time, the county would probably argue that the judge has to follow the law on and the contracts and all of that stuff on the MSD, regardless of whether the city's pension agreement stays intact. And I think there were even provisions in the pension agreement about if certain employees left or whatever. But that's obviously all in the weeds. They are basically back to kind of square one, so we'll see.
With the county pushing this and nothing comes of it, what's at stake? Is it as urgent as they make it sound?
It is urgent because there's a consent decree. Basically, the MSD has to make it so that raw sewage does not flow into the rivers and streams and basements of people in this region. And they're mandated to fix it, and it's going to cost, you know, $3 billion plus. And this is kind of the one of the biggest projects. It is the biggest project, I think, going on.
And just quickly, there's some timeliness to that, too, because they completed phase one. They're attempting to start phase two. And not surprisingly, the city has one plan. The county has another plan.
There's major disagreement on it.
And one is, I think the county's plan is 5 years. The city's plan is 10 years. The price tags are different. And that has to be settled. And as a matter of fact, that's before the judge, too, because they filed both of them. And then I guess he's going to have to pick one or negotiate.
And the county doesn't want to raise rates. They believe that they can put that off and not do it, basically, for a while. The city is saying reality here, folks, is that we have to raise rates to get this done. So there's even disagreement on that. There's disagreement on literally every single thing that you could possibly think of with this situation.
Let's go back downtown now and talk about the Millennium Hotel.
Yeah.
It's the largest hotel in the area. Mayor John Cranley has called it a public nuisance. Chris, you had an exclusive report this week saying that public records detail the state of that hotel, and also that an investor is interested. Let's start with the state of it.
Right.
What did you find?
Well, we found the public record. Well, we got public records from the city. Basically, there were a number of issues with it. You know, there's a ballroom that's out of commission, that there was some leakage from the pool that really shut the ballroom down, and a lack of fire suppression system in there. And they were removing asbestos, and they need a permit to do that. And so there's some problems related to that that are kind of going on. I think they said they had about 20 rooms out of commission. For perspective, this hotel has more than eight. I think it's about 800 rooms roughly. And so we also took a tour of it, and it was obviously provided by management. So, you know, take that for the grain of salt that it deserves to have. But we picked some rooms out randomly, and, you know, it's a dated hotel, right? It's not a hotel that's modern, you know, but the rooms were fairly clean. And, you know, there was like a room where the shade didn't open all the way. So I think you're going to, you know, if you stay in this hotel, you're going to find problems like that. Whether it's a public nuisance or not is another question. The Hotel Association for the State and a lawyer that I talked to, who's kind of been involved in some other public nuisance actions, really kind of question whether this meets that definition that both the mayor and prosecutor Joe Dieters are, you know, at least have said that they're going to pursue publicly. Neither of them returned my calls and texts on this, so we're not sure, you know, what their reaction was to the public records that have been produced. And those were public records based on the health inspection, and they brought in about 10 people the day that Dieters and Cranley announced that they wanted to do a public nuisance lawsuit on this. So that's kind of where it is. Dated hotel, but...
You made a call to them, and you identify yourself as a reporter, and you say you want to come down and take a look?
No, I didn't want to take a tour with them, but I wanted to say, hey, look, you know, we have the public records. You know, here's what they say. Do you still think it's a public nuisance? That was the question. And how would you respond to the Hotel Association of Ohio and, you know, some of the other legal opinions that this really doesn't meet the definition of public nuisance?
Do they have any explanation for the poor condition of some of those areas?
You know, what they said was there was, you know, some kind of leakage of a gasket with a pool, and that was kind of what caused the problems. The hotel association person I talked to said, you know, these are things that happen in a hotel. You know, they're not atypical, and they are moving to fix these problems. And usually that's enough for a city or a local government. As long as you're actively trying to fix the problems with something, the city is usually okay with that.
And now, in spite of terrible Yelp reviews and all of this public attention to the condition of the hotel, someone right. wants to invest.
Yes, there. A couple of sources told us that they were that there is a serious negotiation offer going on regarding some investment in the hotel. We kind of pressed those folks to tell us the name of that local investor, and to no avail. So we can't really tell you who it is, but you know, that's a potential movement there. Now, there's been a lot of talk over the years about people coming in, you know, with this hotel. So only time will tell, and I know that's a cliche, but only time will tell to see how serious this really is. But there are some discussions going on about it.
And it sounds like the investor is here in town.
It's a local investor.
Okay. And then how does somebody overcome the reputation of the Millennium? Is this something where you tear it down and rebuild?
There's like basically two options here. You tear it down or you gut it. And, you know, some of it's a little difficult to gut. We were in one of the conference rooms, and, you know, it just shows kind of how dated it is. It's like the ceiling is kind of low. You know, it's probably 8 or 9 foot ceiling. So it feels not very modern. And so those are some of the issues that you have there. And reminder, it's two towers. It's not just one tower. So there was one tower that actually used to be a Sheraton. It used to have two different hotel chain flags on it. And so all of that's a challenge, and we'll see what happens.
Any timeline on when this could come
about? With these negotiations, I think that if there's a nuisance lawsuit that's going to be filed, I would expect that to be filed in weeks. Whether there's, you know, if there's a deal on the investment, maybe that puts off this nuisance lawsuit. We'll see.
So maybe when the new music venue opens, we'll have hotel.
I was just getting ready to make a joke. You can put together a timeline. Which happens first, the music venue, MSD resolved, or the Millennium remodeled?
I wouldn't take bets on most of that.
All right. Thanks. Thanks to Cincinnati Business Courier columnist and reporter Chris Wetterich and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman for the fun segment today. Appreciate you both. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We may see another special session of the Kentucky General Assembly if Governor Matt Bevin gets his way, but not only is he battling Democrats, he's also at odds with leaders of his own Republican Party. And that's not his only ongoing spat. Bevin took a shot at the head coach of the Louisville women's basketball team. This all started on Twitter, and then Bevin doubled down on the radio. Let's talk about it. Louisville Courier-Journal State House reporter Tom Loftus is with us on the phone. Welcome, Tom.
Glad to be here, Michael.
The General Assembly passed a new pension bill in the recently concluded legislative session, and Governor Matt Bevin vetoed it. Tom, tell us what was in this particular bill.
This was a narrow bill. This bill was not a comprehensive benefit reform plan, which the governor has said we badly need. It was narrowly focused on what has become known as the quasi-governmental agencies, things like county health departments, regional mental health centers, rape crisis centers, spouse abuse places, these groups that joined years ago when the state pension fund was in good shape, joined that fund and are members of it. They face, starting on July 1, about a 70% increase in their pension costs that they're obliged to pay to that poorly funded pension fund as part of the plan for that fund to get back on its feet. This bill would have given them relief from that. It would have delayed those higher rates for another year and meanwhile set up a structure under which these groups which, by the way, also include some state universities, including Northern Kentucky University.
That's right. This is legislation that was supported by NKU President Ashish Vadia, for sure.
Very much so. Very much so. This would have given them a relief and a way out to pay up their liabilities they owe, either in a lump sum or over time, and get out of this plan. And it was passed on the last day of the session, meaning last day of the session, General Assembly was out of town and doesn't meet again until next year. They have no power to override a governor's veto if he vetoes a bill after they've left town. Well, that's exactly what Governor Bevin did. It stunned legislators of both parties who were expecting, despite the problems in the bill, and it's an immensely complex bill, despite the problems with it that everybody agrees exist, they were expecting the governor to sign it, and it's an issue we can revisit next year. But the governor vetoed it, said he will call a special session before those higher rates hit July 1 and provide some relief to these groups at this special session. The governor has told reporters this week that he doesn't think it has to be a very complicated deal, but it's a simple matter of fixing this bill. I don't think it's going to be that simple, and we'll see. He hasn't said when specifically he will call that session.
And now he's battling with Senate President Robert Stivers, a fellow Republican, and even Senate Majority Floor Leader Damon Thayer, a Republican from Georgetown, who also represents Grant County and part of Southern Kenton County up in our area. What does this do for Republican morale in a gubernatorial election year?
Oh, well, it doesn't help, that's for sure. And the governor's got, he's got some problems within the Republican Party before this all started. But when he gets criticized as harshly as Senator Thayer, for instance, who is as close an ally as the governor has in the General Assembly, that's trouble. This is such a difficult problem to fix, and the legislature thought it had put it aside for the time being. And I think they felt that the governor it indicated to them, which the governor says is not so, that he could be supportive of this, would sign it, or at least allow it to become law without his signature. I think they feel that he's overextended his executive power. Surely he's got a power to veto, but we got no indication, they say, in fact, just the opposite, that he had the sort of problem, the problems he says he had with this bill. It's a political thing. It's also a personal thing to these legislators. They work hard from January through March. They put the session behind them, and they got to get on with their regular lives. And this is the second time the governor has called he hasn't called it yet. That's an important point. But he, back in December, he called them into a special session, gave them 4 or 5 hours' notice. It was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he said, "I'm convening a special session at 8 o'clock this evening." They don't like being whipsawed around like this when they've got to get on with their lives, and they don't see an easy solution that'll fit what the governor wants. They were told me this morning that, hey, the ball's in the governor's court. He's got to present us a bill now that will get some majority support in the House and Senate, it's totally his obligation to take care of this. Otherwise, Thayer said, these groups are just going to have to pay the price when the higher rates slam them come July 1, and we'll see what we can do when we're back in regular session.
Matt Bevin is only the third Republican governor in the last 50 years or so. If he's elected this year, he'd be the first in history to win a second term in that office as a Republican. Of course, Kentucky's only fairly recently allowed 2 terms. I want to read a quote from journalist Al Cross. He was quoted in Fox News this morning. Quote, "Bevin's trouble comes largely because he has a reckless mouth. He goes after teachers in a sometimes outrageous way. A lot of teachers are Republicans, and a lot of Republicans are teachers. Teachers are still well thought of in rural Kentucky. If not for teachers, Bevin would be a prohibitive favorite for reelection," end quote. And so on the theme of reckless mouth, the governor has also managed to find some time to blast the head coach of the Louisville women's basketball team, Jeff Walls. And a lot of us up here in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky know Jeff Walls as a Fort Thomas native, Highlands graduate. His sister, Jamie Walls, was a legendary player up here, Miss Kentucky basketball back in 1996. Tom, very quickly, what's the story here?
Well, the governor put out a tweet a few weeks ago when University of Kentucky men's team made it to the Elite Eight, congratulating them. Coach Walls responded with a tweet of his own where he gigged the governor for not mentioning the U of L women, who were also in the Elite Eight of the NCAA women's tournament. The governor responded in an interview on WHAS radio here in Louisville, saying, "I feel bad saying this, but it's true. If he, meaning Walls, had been a little more focused on game strategy and coaching that weekend and a little less on this kind of silliness, the better team would have won. We got out coached straight up." So he took that shot at Walls and stirred the pot, and that's created a lot of activity on Twitter and social media and so forth. So, but it's the governor's style. He's a lot like President Trump. He says things, and makes a lot of off-point news and unusual news, to put it lightly.
Yeah, I don't know that there's much precedent for a governor taking a jab at one of the state's schools after losing in March Madness.
Well, you know, it strikes me that it would have been a good opportunity to tweet back and say, "Hey, sorry I overlooked that, coach. U of L women did a great job this year," or something. But he took a shot at the coach instead, and I don't know. That sort of thing dealing with basketball may politically have more of an impact than what the governor says about pensions, which generally cause folks' eyes to glaze over. It's so complicated. But people understand basketball in Kentucky.
That's right. There are 3 Democrats seeking to replace Bevin next year: former state auditor Adam Edlin, the current Attorney General Andy Beshear, and House Minority Leader Rocky Atkins. I got to ask you, in our last 30 seconds here, are they smelling blood in the water?
No, I don't think so. I think it's so difficult to defeat an incumbent governor, and Governor Bevin has a base here, and he's got a campaign strategy and issues he will hit on, the economy, social issues, like his opposition to abortion. He's going to be difficult to beat by any of them, but I do think that his controversial nature, his tendency to take swipes at people, opens the door and makes him vulnerable in a way that he needn't be.
Yeah, he'd have to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, it sounds like. Tom Loftus from the Louisville Courier-Journal, I appreciate you joining us today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks to producer Pete Reitmeier, assistant producer Selena Reeder, technical director Josh Elstro. Find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.